are we good? Does everybody have what they need? Okay, what you have here is the tshuva that I'm working with, but also pieces of it have been translated. So whatever pieces I could find that were translated, I included in case you want to refer to those excerpts that were translated. At any rate, we're going to dive into this tshuva, and it's a very famous tshuva, because it deals with a famous question, and that is mixed youth groups in post-World War II France. That an organization called Yeshurun, and it's about, a major piece of it, is about the singing of boys and girls together at the Shabbos table. The tshuva alone, I think if you look at it, points really to a powerful portrait of post-World War II Europe and its aftermath. And I think that anybody who went to Yeshiva Elementary School, when I did, remembers going around from door to door with our little stickers and selling stickers for an organization called Tashbar that was really there to save French Jewish children from assimilation. So as you read this, some of that may come back, and some of the work that we did door to door may come back to you. Okay? So just to give you some of the background, a group of well-known Haredim have opposed this sort of NCSY kind of organization that was started to take root in France after World War II. And Rav Weinberg, in his tshuva, quotes all the sources on machitza, on separation between men and women, and he even reminds us of the fact, something you may not want to hear, but the Rambam talks about this, that there were policemen who used to patrol the streets in Yerushalayim during the Shlosh Regalim, and they would patrol the parks and sometimes even private homes to make sure that there was not too much socializing, inappropriate socializing, going on during the Shlosh Regalim, I'm saying, even in people's houses. Think about some pastora in your neighborhood. So that's basically, they didn't want things to disintegrate Yerushalayim. He also feels that the issues regarding Kol Isha that the Haredi community was bringing up with regard to this are very, very serious issues, and he's extremely respectful of the seriousness of those issues. So what I would like everybody to do is for a moment, I'm going to really look at it inside. In the second column that you have, I have an arrow and a bracket, and it says Mikol Makom. So having listed some of these sources and validating the serious issues, this is what he says. Mikol Makom, he says, nevertheless, Kishin Sh'alti Al Zeh, Mimin Halei Yeshurun, when I was asked about this from the heads of this organization, Yeshurun, Horeiti Lehem Shiyam Shichu Et Pu'ulatam, this was an organization that really had started in Germany, and he said you should keep going the way the Gedolim of Germany had told you to. These were great tzaddikim, all their intentions were for the purpose of Hashem. And their purpose was to save German youth from assimilation. That was a very big issue in Germany in their days. And through their efforts in NCSY today, they were very successful in saving many, many youth. I'm just going to read a little bit more because this language is so important. And the Gedolim of Germany, they were like experts in education. They were successful in raising really entire generations of Balei Yirei Shamayim v'Hashkalah Chilonit Ke'achad, those who were both secularly educated and also Yirei Shamayim. Mashalo Allah b'yidei ga'onei Gedolei Lita u'Poland. Something that the Gedolim of Lithuania and Poland were not successful, they weren't really good at sort of working with the changing times. That wasn't their forte. They were good at holding down the fort, and excellent at that, and we need that, but they weren't as good as moving with the times. And so, You see here that the rabbis of Poland and Hungary, who were in France at that time, they're objecting to what they're seeing in France because they don't understand the problems of this place. And their demands are putting this organization, Yeshurun, in danger. That's what's going on. Number two, he goes on to explain the problems of assimilation and mixed marriage among the young people of France, and especially among those families who experienced the Holocaust. You take a look from in the third column, where I have a bracket. Everybody see it? There's a bracket in the third column where we were. And again, I want us to learn it and feel it and start to understand this man through his own language. Hagoreim ha'ikari l'matzav ha'ma'atzir v'ha'mavish sh'nolad b'tzarfat ולפי דעתי רגש הבדידות המעיף על ליבו של הנוער היהודי. This problem, I think, this depressing and foul problem that starts in France, he says, is because of the sense of isolation that is like oppressing the young people there. הנער או הנערה היהודית מרגיש את עצמו בודד ומעזב נפשו. They feel all alone. אין לו אחיזה נפשית בקרב הבית או המשפחה של הרב הרבד. Doesn't feel like there's a spiritual stronghold in the house of his parents. הבית והמשפחה של אחינו בצרפת נתרוקנו מנחלת אבותיהם וממסורתם של הבית היהודי חי ורענן. It's completely empty of any kind of living, exciting, fresh Jewish experience. אין בהם סימן של חיים. There's just nothing alive for them in Judaism. Hadidifa chare hakesef, but tanigot olam asta shamut b'kirban v'garma b'tikat ol Torah mitzvot. It's like running. Does that mean it's not the money? Running after like money and physical pleasure and fulfillment just caused them to just throw off all the entire yoke of Torah and mitzvot. Hatzair hayehudi. Becomes a teenager, starts to mature, he feels he's alone. Hayahadut kufi ha-metoda shel ha-ra'at ha-zikinim ha-yishishim yisub ha-yashan hu ba'inav chayiv shel nizirut u-bididot. According to the way the older generations teaches Judaism, it's a life of being alone. V'halimud atzmo v'rgush atzmo shamum. It's just boring and exhausting. The et hayahadut heimavun ki inyan ghetto ruchani shel yimei habeinayim. It's a spiritual ghetto. You know, what hope is there for that? They're cut off. They feel cut off of everything, and there's nothing in Judaism that they feel they can relate to. So Rav Weinberg goes on to tackle the cult issue, not performance. Let's everybody be very clear. There's nobody who thinks that you could just sit there and listen to them and sing. Okay? He's not tackling the issue of performance, but the issue of singing zmiros together at the table. Can men and women, girls and boys, sing zmiros together at the table? And he notes how shocked he was to find men and women singing together in the frumish poems. And he came to Germany from Eastern Europe. And he feels that in the halacha, this practice is b'di'evet. It's completely not optimal. And yet he bows to the wisdom of the German educators who preceded him. These men, he said, understood the women of their times and succeeded in educating generations of enthusiastically observant women. If you just go to the next page, we'll just do a little bit more. You turn to the next page and have a lot of arrows, a lot of brackets, and you should really read the whole thing. If you look at the second column, at the very, very bottom of the second column, I have an arrow in the margin. Does everybody see? In the second column, there's an arrow. There's lots of arrows, but there's one in the margin, and then look at the second word in over there. It starts with the ado. Speaking about these German educators, v'yadu ruach banot hador shechanku b'vatei sefer ולמדו לשונות ומדעים שיש להם רגש של כבוד עצמאי, והם מראות אלבון ודחיפה לחוץ למחנה, באיסור שאוסרים עליהם לשתף בזמירות קודש. They knew the spirit of the girls of that time who were educated in schools, which is not always true that the girls in Poland were. They learned different foreign languages, they learned the sciences, and they had a certain sense of self-respect and independence, and they saw themselves embarrassed, as if they were being pushed away by not being allowed to sit at the table and sing zmiras with everybody. And therefore, using the logic that's in here, which he agrees is b'di'evet, not optimal. If there's something, if there's a word I use, please stop me, and I'd be very happy to go over it again and translate that. It's not optimal. Nevertheless, because people are singing and not listening to the others, but everybody's singing together, they allow it. Okay? He calls this, this was a time of expediency, Eit la'asot la'Hashem, heferu taratecha, the time when we have to do something to save Klal Yisrael, much as we read with Eliyahu Hanavi yesterday, in the Haftorah, sometimes we have to do something that looks like you're like destroying the Torah, but really what you're trying to do is to save the Torah. And we'll finish up with the third column on this page, with my first big arrow and graphic that says Ube Peirush. Does everybody see it? It's a big word. Ube Peirush. I have with those people that I've written to above. She'aim, this is very important. This is a very special feature of the Sri Deyesh Vipulsi. She'aim l'chof al hanashim she'tzrichot l'hishtate bizmirot kodesh. Ve'im yipatzu l'hachmir al atzmam chalila Lil oz aleihem ulehit lotzeitz bahem shere sof kol sof minhag avotenu hagdoshim biyadai shenisharu miletil v'mashim atil zmirat kodesh. But he said, because I'm saying that it's okay in this not optimal but the other situation, he said, that doesn't mean that when you have a daughter who says, I don't want to sing at the table with everybody, you don't make fun of her and say, what's with you? Right? You have flipped out, right? You say, right? Yasha Kalach to you. She is holding on to the Mesorah of our Chachamim, who in fact saw this as a B'di'evet. So even though I'm saying it's okay, for those, but you don't start forcing people to do this, you know, what's the matter with you? Okay, which we know is the other part of the problem of what we're dealing with today. So I wanted to point that out. Yeah. Okay. This is a powerful tshuva, a powerful and moving language that indicates to us sensitivity to changing times, to women, and understanding that not all methods work in all situations. It indicates love and respect for both the German rabbinic leaders and the Eastern European Haredim. It has an intellectual honesty, halachic depth and breadth, if you read the entire tshuva and see everything he quotes. So who was this person? Everything that's written about him is subtitled in such a way as to indicate that the author of the Sri Deyesh is a bridge between Eastern and Western Europe, between those communities, between the yeshiva world and modern orthodoxy. Now I want to ask you something. How many personalities are you aware of who merit an essay in the Art Scroll Torah Personality Series? Does everybody know the Art Scroll Torah? Have you seen books like this in your bookstore? There's a whole stack of them. This is the first one. What this is a collection of biographies. Often when a gadol would die, so the Jewish Observer, which I miss very, I know we're here in a whining thing, I miss the Jewish Observer very much. And this is a collection of the biographies that were printed in the Jewish Observer. And there are many, many volumes that came after this. So how many people do you know who would merit a biography in this Art Scroll series, as well as a 100-page essay in the YU Orthodox Forum? Not too many people. Okay, so I can tell you that in addition, there were aspects of his life that were material for a number of articles in YU's Torah Umada journal. Fascinating articles. All before the appearance of the scholarly biography of historian Mark Shapiro, which we'll talk about. Probably one of my all-time favorite books. I started reading it in the back of the room when I was proctoring the exam. And I was like, oh my God, what am I going to do? I can't put it down. I was going to take a look at it. It's called, what? The title is Between the Yeshiva World and Modern Orthodoxy, The Life and Works of Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg. Mark Shapiro. I'll tell you some of the stuff that's in this. Unbelievable. Okay. I have to tell you that on a personal level, that morning when I just said, let me just take a look and see what's there, I got very excited. Because Rav Weinberg was known as the Eloi of Chechenovitz. My mother was born in America, but her family came from Chechenovitz. And as I was reading that morning, he was a very close friend of Rav Avram Kamai, who was the Rav of the Mir. And my father was born in America, but he would speak about Rav Avram Kamai. I have a nephew named after Rav Avram Kamai. So here in this gadol, I had like somebody who, like on an intellectual level, joined for me the history of both my father and my mother. Like I didn't know what to do with myself. It was amazing. Well, a man brought together so much of what Orthodox Jewish life had to offer in the early 10th century. I have to tell you that he was also a man of tremendous internal conflict. I told you that as a child, Rav Weinberg was known as the Eloi of Chechenovitz. He was educated in the bastions of the Lithuanian yeshiva world, in the Mir and in Slabodka, which was a yeshiva that was famous for bringing together the integrity and the diligent Torah study of the Lithuanian yeshivas along with the Musar movement. So he served as a rav in this little town called Mishki, and then he left for the University of Giessen in Germany, where he earned a doctorate, and he also became a member of the faculty. Just as a little note backwards, a very big tragedy in his life is that in his early days, in order to become the Rav of Polishki, he was encouraged to marry the daughter of a deceased Rav, and it was a horrible marriage with a very simple-minded young woman. And they divorced 16 years later, and they had no children. And he never married again. So that's like a sort of like something you need to be aware of in his history. Dayan Grunfeld, the famous Hirschian scholar who translated so many of Hirsch's works into English, wrote in his Jewish Observer essay the following. As a young student, I attended Rav Weinberg's lectures at the University of Giessen. His lectures were always crowded. Not only students of theology, but Oriental languages were there as well. He writes, students and of other faculties and even university professors sat at his feet, impressed by the depth of his thought and enchanted by the slow and deliberate manner of his lecturing and his deep, sonorous speaking voice. I can never forget his brilliant strictures against Bible criticism and his convincing arguments in favor of the authenticity of Jewish tradition. Few were able to combine Talmudic and biblical scholarship as Rabbi Weinberg did. With his sharp dialectical mind and his wide range of knowledge, this proud Lithuanian Jew did not find it difficult to impart, even to non-Jewish listeners, a deep respect for Jewish traditional values. Pre-World War II. So interesting to note that the age of 20, before all of this, after a year and a half of study at the Mir, Rav Weinberg left to study the Russian language in Grodno. Knowing of Rav Weinberg's genius and his attraction to secular studies and to Haskalah, Rav Nosson Tzvi Finkel, the great author of Slobodka, where he had studied, actually followed him physically to Grodno to prevent him from going on with these studies. Rav Nosson Tzvi Finkel even got the Chafetz Chaim himself to summon Rav Weinberg away from Grodno. You're not going to fight with the Chafetz Chaim. Rav Weinberg left, and he continued his Talmud studies. And ironically, he attributed his success in achieving a secular education to the Chafetz Chaim. Mark Shapiro writes in a footnote that, quote, no doubt he meant that had he not waited until he was firmly grounded in his Talmudic studies before tackling secular studies, he would have remained mediocre in both. In 1924, Rav Weinberg joined the faculty, left Eastern Europe, joined the faculty of the Berlin Rabbinical Seminary. And in 1931, he was asked to assume the leadership of the Hildesheimer Seminary to fill in the shoes of the great Gaon, Rav Avraham Elyeh Kaplan, which is a famous story in its own right. And, you know, when I read, like, of Rav Avraham Elyeh Kaplan, who was this incredible genius who was working on things in the Yerushalmi and the Parshim and translation, I cry for the lack of knowledge of history that we have. When you read of the funeral of Rav Avraham Elyeh Kaplan, who died suddenly as a young man, the authors, and it might be Rav Grunfeld in a small old book called Three Generations, writes that German men who never cried for anything wept openly in the streets at his Leviathan. We don't even know his name. Terrifying. That there were these amazing people who walked the earth and we don't know who they were. So Rav Weinberg filled the shoes, or was supposed to try to fill the shoes of Rav Avraham Kaplan. So this seminary was guided by his founder, Rav Israel Hildesheimer. In his introduction to the Sri Deish, Rav Weinberg writes that Rav Hildesheimer, and it's sort of my loose translation because there's no translation, argue that it's not enough in our day for rabbis to know the teaching of what is permissible and forbidden, heter v'isser, kosher and treif, pure and impure, these things that are the foundation of Jewish life. Rather, they need also to stand before the big world and prove the righteousness of Judaism and its eternal truth, even taking into account secular knowledge. And quote, our generation needs to know that Judaism is not just a collection of laws, but a spiritual force in the life of humanity. The seminary's goal was to produce rabbis such as these, and it did. It succeeded admirably. Ultimately, Rav Weinberg was deeply affected by the Shoah on many levels. I'll give you as an example. In the early 1930s, the Nazis, the great animal rights activists that they were, outlawed shechita unless the animal was first anesthetized. Rav Chaim Ozer Grudzinski, the reigning gadol in Europe after the death of the Chafetz Chaim, asked Rav Weinberg to research the topic of electrical stunning of animals, whether they would be halachically permissible to do that before Shechita, and that would then fulfill the Nazi requirements. Rav Weinberg researched the science and the biology and all of the halacha as he was uniquely qualified to do, and although he considered it a major b'dieved, he ultimately concluded that stunning, himon, was permissible. Recognizing the validity of his halachic conclusions, but very concerned that changing the method of shechita would create A, the impression that what had gone on previously was not humane, and B, it would change how shechita had been done for thousands of years, Rav Chaim Ozer Grudzinski and others asked Rav Weinberg not to publish his tshuva. In his incredible humility and in his great understanding that halacha is more than just research, Rav Weinberg yielded willingly to the psak of Rav Chaim Ozer and the rabbis who he considered greater than himself. This acquiescence wasn't just something pragmatic, it was a part of his philosophy. And he remained consistent with this philosophy his whole life. I
marked it,
I hope I can find it. It's a quote in the Judith Bleich article on this topic, the 100-page article that she wrote. I won't read his entire quote because he said that, well, let me do a job. He says, according to my opinion, one should not seek permissive rulings from rabbis or halachic authorities, for I know that this permissive ruling will not be acceptable to some God-fearing who do not want, under any circumstances, to make changes. And he's speaking as the civil practice of shkita, customary from time immemorial. Judith Bleich goes, well, let me read him. He says, therefore, let the matter rest, for such a permissive ruling will lead to a dissension, lead to dissension and to the fashioning of two Torahs in Israel. Rav Weinberg would not, this is Judith Bleich speaking, would not countenance any innovation that carried with it the potential for splitting the community. Rav Weinberg's exhortations regarding the danger of Fisher and of the tragedy inherent in making two Torahs did not stem from a lack of courage or a fear of factions on the right or on the left, but from a deep-seated love and appreciation of the grandeur of Kal Yisrael. Unbelievable. Put himself aside. His comprehensive tshuvot on stunning, on Himon, were not published until the 1960s, and I must tell you that they remain an invaluable source on the halachos of Shechita and a reminder of the insanity of Nazis who worried more about cattle and less about pepless men and women who were transported in cattle cars. When I think about this, I just have to think that I guess the community of beasts has to take care of itself. Most poignant about Rav Weinberg is probably so much of German Jewry at that time, like him, felt that despite the anti-Jewish edicts that followed Hitler's rise in 1933, despite the endless pursuit of research regarding stunning of animals that tells like the whole story in itself, despite the fact that Rav Weinberg and others, and I include Rav Breuer and Rav Monk, accepted their portion as second-class citizens. One of the incredible features of this book is the appendix that has letters of Rav Breuer and Rav Munk to Hitler. To Hitler himself, saying, if you leave us alone, we'll just be good little Jews, and we understand why you're, you know, and we'll just sit quiet. You know, you have to read it to understand. Like, we have 20/20 hindsight now. You have to read this to understand what the mindset was. But nobody saw this coming. Rav Weinberg felt Germany would continue to need good rabbis in the future, and he rejected the efforts of the Hildesheimer Seminary to move to Eretz Yisrael. Pay attention to the date. In October 1938, Rav Weinberg visited Warsaw recruiting students. And he told everyone not to worry about German Jewry. He, in fact, discouraged Jews from leaving Germany. And how shocked he was by Kristallnacht the following month when the great seminary locked its doors. Never. The day after Kristallnacht, Mark Shapiro reports that Zionist leader Zarathustra Haftar visited Rav Weinberg and found him so crushed that he was not capable of carrying on a conversation. Several weeks later, when Rav Weinberg realized that it was over forever, Mark Shapiro writes that one of Rav Weinberg's students visited him and found, quote, a broken man crying over what had occurred. I am happy to tell you that just about every single faculty member and student of the seminary was able to find a place of refuge, and that Rav Weinberg was instrumental in helping many of them. He himself was quite ill at the time, and I have to tell you that he battled with depression, and we'll talk about that in the time, you know, when people did not recognize depression as an illness. He battled terribly, and I'm reading you not from Mark Shapiro, but from articles printed in the Israeli press in Hebrew upon his death. I'm quoting you from his obituaries in Hadoar and in other places that speak about this. He himself was unable to travel to the United States and to England or to Eretz Yisrael, despite many, many invitations to come. After being physically removed from his home in Berlin by the Gestapo, Rav Weinberg went to Kovno, which is the twin city of Slobodka. He went there for medical help, and he went to Warsaw and to Lublin, and he found himself, in, of all places, in Warsaw on September 1st, 1939, when the Nazis invaded Poland. During the war period, he was elected as the head of the Agudas Harabonim of Warsaw in Poland, and he writes, with irony, but who knows, maybe even some truth, that he was appointed because there were so many great rabbis there at the time, of Nachum Zemba Hashem and Kom Damo, that they couldn't decide among themselves who the head should be. So he says the easiest thing was to appoint him, because he didn't rank in stature with any of them, and then that solved all the controversies. Rav Weinberg ended up, crazily enough, being protected by the Germans. Happened was Lithuania, of which he was an actual citizen, was taken over by the Soviets, with whom the Germanies, for a few moments during the war, was at peace. And by the way, if you want to read an unbelievable story, you can read the story of how the Mir Yeshiva left the Mir and went to Vilna during that time when there was protection there in Vilna and Lithuania. It's like a crazy story with unbelievable ramifications for Hashgacha. And so Rav Weinberg at that time was treated like a Soviet citizen and not as a Jew. And when Germany and the Soviets were back on opposite sides again, Weinberg, because he was an important rabbi, was protected by the Germans in case they needed him to trade prisoners. So, go figure. Despite this, Weinberg experienced the horrors of the Warsaw Ghetto, was imprisoned in the Pavia concentration camp when Germany and the USSR went to war with each other. And in 1945, after being freed from the prisoner of war camp where Soviets were being held, it became apparent that Rav Weinberg had no idea of the complete decimation of the Jews. How do we know this? He asked, after being free, to go to Warsaw or to Kovno, having no idea that these places no longer existed as Jewish communities. The shock of this caused his health to deteriorate again, and he was hospitalized for 9 months in Nuremberg, of all places, and was under care for depression, some say, for more than 3 years. Remember, he's alone. You know, he doesn't have a family. After the war and hospitalization, the Weinberg went to live with a family for close student in Montreux, Switzerland, the Weinberg family. And their great rabbis and students sought him out, where he wrote great tshuvos, one of which we looked at the beginning. He was never again affiliated with any institution, and we'll come back to this in a minute. That was on purpose. Beginning in 1961, Ophelia Weinberg began publishing his responsa with the autobiographical introduction to the 3-day H. We understand immediately that he never ever recovered from his experiences. After thanking Hashem for saving him from his beloved Berlin, which he now calls the capital of evil, he quotes directly from Perek Gimel of Eicha. Ani ha-geta.
I can't even read it, because, you know, when I was studying this, when I was doing these tshuvos and preparing for a class, I just wanted to find out about this man. The only thing about him was the Diane Grunfeld article in the art school book. So every time I came upon more things, I was like discovering like a precious jewel, like more about this person who I only knew from his writing. Ani ha-geta ra'an, the shaven of Rachel, I am the man who has seen this oppression, right, and the wrath of the Ribono Shel Olam's rod. In a wrenching paragraph, some of which I have for you, he testifies to what he saw in the Warsaw Ghetto. And this man, who loved culture and German academic life, writes of the Nazis as, quote, people lacking the human conscience, whose ruthlessness was worse by many times the cruelest predatory beasts. He attributes his salvation to a miracle. He speaks of the great giants of the yeshiva world who are lost. And then he writes, and this I don't have for you, I have pieces of it, but not this piece. Rada tcho chazani, ubusha techaseh kanai, rabo lesaper al hanisim v'hanifla'ot, shina'asu in ezov katan kamoni. I tremble to tell you about the miracles that occurred to a little leftover chaos, or nothing, like me. Asher lo eida b'melechlot neis hatzalati. I don't understand to what to attribute the miracles that occurred to me. B'vadai lo mischut yitera, not because of my great merit. Ela mimi'ut zuchut, because of my lack of merit. V'himanot vein magdishei Hashem hagadol v'hanala. I did not merit to be included among those who sanctified God's name by dying in the Shoah. He goes on to tell us how he was removed from his house by the Gestapo with just the clothes on his back. He writes, they didn't let me take anything. All my writings, responsa, chidushim, and research were lost. There were 3 books about to be published, gone forever. Only one little bundle was saved by one dear student whom he describes as, and this is the irony, Harav Hagaon Gadol Torah Umada, Dr. Eliezer Berkovitz. The irony is that Eliezer Berkovitz himself is a very, very controversial figure who was considered ultimately to be at the edges of orthodoxy. And he knew that when he wrote it. He watched over this little bundle in London, I'm translating, through the bombing, and when he had to hide in bomb shelters, he took it everywhere with him and never left it until the war was over, and he found me where I was finally, and he returned my writings to me. This is how Rav Weinberg's writings came to be known as the 3-day H, Remnants Saved from the Fire, a title which no doubt applied to himself as well as to his writings. After speaking of the beautiful yeshiva that he was a part of, he begins to conclude, and I have this for you. Let's see. It's on the last page. On the last page. What I would like for everybody to do is, I don't want to read the whole thing, it's too long, the last paragraph. He writes about his Talmidim. I want everybody to think about this Hildesheimer Academy, the great institution that it was. Think for a minute, we're here representing YU today. Think of YU. Think of Shar Yashav,
Think of the yeshivas in this area. Think of the yeshivas that your children go to and that you support. Think of the yeshivas that your rabbi got smicha from. Last paragraph. Beit Midrashenu HaGadol Harav Yavonoteinu Harabim. Our Beit Midrash was destroyed because of our many sins, a common phrase that's used in halakhic writing. Avod Zichro HaKadosh Lo Yaseif Mikerav Leiv Tamidav. Its memory will never cease from the hearts of its Talmidim. Rabbi Nehem Alu Gdura Umechanim Pe'er Ba'arim Gdolot B'chol Rachaber Ha'olam Ha'yudi Umechadshim Umachavim Shein Yisrael B'Shein Toratein V'Emunato. Many of them rose to greatness in different positions all over the world and are among those who sanctify Hashem's name and our faith. Others went to Eretz Yisrael and called them to Rabbanim of Morim, and they are rabbis and teachers. Va'omdim b'rosh hachinuch hadati, and stand at the head of religious education there. Va'chadim omdim b'rosh hashulchan hamalachti, and some stand at the head of government. V'cholam osim chizuk v'torat Yisrael v'Eretz Yisrael, and they're all doing something to strengthen Torah in Eretz Yisrael. Yehei Shmo HaGadol Baruch Mavrach, may the name of our great yeshiva always be blessed. Ya'amod Nas Ifriza, my little sefer should stand to Matseva Tznu'a, a modest Matseva Lebeit Midash Ma'at Shemeshach Shmonim Shana, that for the 80 years he fits Torah v'orah with Zurei Yisrael, that spread Torah for 80 years all over Europe. Rav Weinberg is buried on Har HaMenuchot in Eretz Yisrael. The description of this funeral, which can be found in the footnote of Judith Watt's essay, and with which Mark Shapiro brilliantly begins his book, fascinating in itself. His funeral was a war. One group of yeshiva students wanted him buried at the cemetery in Sanhedria. Another group, headed by Rav Sarna, Yeshiva Chevron, wanted him buried in Har HaMenuchot. And as they were heading one way, the other group prevailed, and they went and buried him the other way. I mean, even in death, there was this. Okay? All right? His life ended in Montreux, Switzerland, in 1966, where he lived for 20 years. Let me read this to you. I promise to come back to this point before I conclude it. It was in Montreux that Weinberg felt able to preserve a semblance of what life had been like before the war, a life which combined Torah, Western civilization, and academic Jewish studies. The synthesis of Berlin Orthodoxy, whose popularity had plummeted even further in the years after the war, was still an option in Montreux. Weinberg believed that he would have been out of place anywhere else, particularly in Israel, if he would have to commit himself to a certain philosophy. As he saw it, by becoming a professor at Bar-Ilan University or a lecturer at a yeshiva, he would have been forced to make a choice between the academic world and the traditional yeshiva world. Whichever world he chose would have required him to sever ties with the other, for he believed that there was little possibility of straddling the two. The right-wing Orthodox, who had generally negative attitude towards secular studies and often viewed academic Jewish studies as nothing less than sacrilegious, would not have accepted him had he joined the university community. On the other hand, the academic world would have regarded him as an obscurantist if he had cast his lot with the right-wing yeshiva. Similarly, had he moved to Israel, he would have not been able to... Listen, you can't believe what I mean. Similarly, had he moved to Israel, he would not have been able to express his Zionist sympathies without risking alienation from the right-wing Orthodox community to which so many of his friends and colleagues belong. Such was Weinberg's evaluation of the sociological realities of post-war Orthodoxy. Only by remaining in Montreux could he live the life he had in Berlin, where it had all been so natural. Only in Montreux was Weinberg able to command the respect of right-wing circles through his great Torah knowledge, and at the same time to continue his commitment to Torah Derech Eretz academic Jewish scholarship and the rebuilding of the land of Israel. To me, Rav Weinberg is the dream gadol, comprising all the best of our Masorah. I'm not sure that any institution in our world could incorporate or replicate all his values and complexities. But as individuals, perhaps we can strive to be more like him. Passionate and spiritual about our Judaism, learned, meticulous in our observance of halakha, open, tolerant, understanding, and accepting of a new and changing world, critical of that which is wrong in the way things have been done, and yet fiercely loyal and deeply respectful of the way things have been done, and of the people who uphold not just halakha, but our oldest traditions. You know that Rav Weinberg's closest friend was a very learned man by the name of Samuel Atlas, who taught at the Reform Hebrew Union College. Go figure. Okay? Rav Weinberg was worried about things that it said in the Gemara and challenged halakha in terms of non-Jews. He couldn't stomach the politics that ruled Haredi life in Eretz Yisrael. Judith Weich writes that it was to the abiding impact and influence of the towering personalities of the Musar movement and to the devotion to Torah Torah of Eastern European Jewry that Rav Weinberg attributes the renaissance of Torah in America and Eretz Yisrael. This is true Ahavas Yisrael and Ahavas HaTorah that we yearn for. What we learn from Rav Weinberg is that this Ahava is very, very difficult. And that it is far from simple, and it is not simplistic Ahavas Yisrael. In many ways, Rav Weinberg was a victim of the polarization of the Orthodox world. He paid a heavy price for refusing any academic or political affiliation. But I would think that he felt that it was worth the effort and the suffering. The Baal Sri De'esh died holding dearly to every one of his cherished beliefs. And yet, he was accepted by everyone. We are living today in fascinating and difficult days for the Orthodox community. But what I would say is that as we face our struggles, we need to work hard to stay whole within ourselves and united as a people. And I would hope that our efforts at Achdus on this very deep and difficult level, that this effort would be our matseva, our monument to this unique individual in the special times he lived in and in the special times that we live in. I encourage you to learn more. Thank you.